Hello and welcome to The Nature Between Us, a podcast for all your eco inquiries and musings. My name is Tessa. I'm an Aussie actress, a voiceover artist, and an environmental master's student on a mission to demystify the big environmental issues of our time. Join me on my quest to find solutions and positivity from the wide variety of people working towards a more sustainable future. This podcast is recorded and produced on Bidjigal and Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and I acknowledge the traditional owners and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This is episode 3, and we're talking about environmental law in the era of climate change. So environmental law has been around since the 1960s, but climate change law is a much more recent development. And while it does exist in some parts of the world, I wanted to know what the situation was here in Australia. And who better to speak to than David Barnden, the founder and principal lawyer of Equity Generation Lawyers, a law firm that specializes in Australian climate change law. Now, you might have heard about Dave and his work in the media recently, as he's filed some pretty progressive cases within the sphere of climate change litigation, two of which are against the Australian government and one against superannuation fund REST. But this isn't the first time Dave has fought for climate justice. Before starting up Equity Generation, he was a principal lawyer at Environmental Justice Australia, where he took on the Commonwealth Bank for failing to disclose climate change risks to investors. David not only has a background in law, but also applied sciences and coastal management. Plus, I heard he was a fellow surfer, so I knew he'd be a good egg. We spoke about the history of environmental regulation in Australia, how COVID is affecting the legal system, the economic impact of climate change inaction on investments and our global reputation, and, of course, we got into the nitty-gritty of the three cases he's currently working on. Alrighty, well, do you want to jump on in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Get cracking. You're the principal lawyer at Equity Generation, and you guys specialize in Australian climate change law, which is quite forward thinking, I think, looking at it from the outside looking in. And you have these three amazing cases that you're working on at the moment that I want to speak to you a little bit later about. But just to start, I kind of wanted to ask, where are we at in terms of environmental law in Australia? Because it seems from the outside looking in and from what I've kind of read about various, you know, coal mines trying to get shut down, it always seems to focus on conservation and biodiversity. So there's some small little creature and we use that as our defense. Why has that historically been the lay of the land in terms of environmental law? And then looking forward, are there any climate change laws in Australia specifically? And if so, what are they?
First of all, there's not that many climate change laws and none that operate to protect people from the impacts of certain projects. And so how environmental law traditionally works is under a piece of legislation called the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. And that protects threatened species and threatened ecosystems. And so usually they are the trigger for government assessments and government requirements for projects to protect them. And so you don't often have a sort of a holistic view of the environment under that piece of legislation. And so what happens is projects get approved, and obviously it happens on a project-by-project basis, and you don't get a sort of a holistic, sort of an aggregated view of the total impacts of, as you know, it's like death by a thousand cuts. And that's one of the problems with the legislation. Another one is that often when it talks about vulnerable ecosystems or flora or fauna, what can happen is that projects get approved with conditions, and they can be conditions such as offsets. So a requirement to have another area which is dedicated to certain species, but that just doesn't work. I mean, yeah. It's not like you can chop down a forest and and say, oh, look, I've got a field over there. Sure, there's no forest on it, but the idea is that we keep it for certain species. It just doesn't work.
Mm. There's lots of criticism about offsets, and that I hear that a lot, that people kind of going, oh, well, yeah, they're doing this much emissions, but they're offsetting it, so it's all fine. But I think that's a fallacy that's kind of just making people feel better about certain situations when, in fact, it's not actually offsetting at all.
Yeah, 100%. It just enables the party to go on, really.
Yeah.
It's a mechanism that is sort of baked into government policy. And, you know, it can be applied to ecosystems, to threatened species and carbon emissions. And it's almost part of the playbook just to keep business as usual going on.
Yeah. And so that Environmental Protection Biodiversity and Conservation Act, it's such a long legislation.
Yeah.
That has recently been in the media quite a bit because it's over 20 years old, and the government decided, I think it was last year, correct me if I'm wrong, that they were going to do a review. What do you know about that? What are they doing?
Yeah. Look, I'm not an expert on it, but there is a requirement for the government to have an independent review of the Act and how it's working every 10 years. And so that happened recently. A report came out by Graham Samuel, and it basically said it wasn't working, that the Act didn't work to protect the environment. The way things are going is completely unsustainable. He said that offsets don't work, and was really critical about just about the state of the Australian environment and how it got there under this piece of legislation. However, before that report came out, the government put forward a bill to what many people think the effect of that bill is actually to weaken it further. And so it's quite a disingenuous response by the government is to say, well, actually, we have this review, but we're not even going to take it into account. We're just going to ram through legislation regardless, and it's going to fit to our agenda. And we're not going to listen to experts. We're not going to listen to independent people who have this statutory role to review the Act and how it works. So, you know, rightly so, they've come under a lot of criticism for that, but it's still going ahead.
Is that going ahead, do you think, has COVID kind of exacerbated that? Because it seems like there's been a few things kind of passed under the carpet. Like there was that extension of the pipeline water, something to do with water through the Sydney region. Anyway, I feel like I've read about a few things, and then there was something down in Victoria, and I'm like, what's going on? Is this because of COVID? Like everyone, you know, they're not being able to exhibit as much, or?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know the exact answer, but what COVID means is that it's difficult to organise. It's difficult to protest, and the global pandemic is taking up a lot of oxygen in the news cycle, and so what may have otherwise been seen as really important sort of headline issues get relegated, and the government doesn't feel the same heat that it may have otherwise felt absent the pandemic. So I think that's a large part of the dynamic, and given that, they can take advantage of the situation by passing laws or doing things which in normal circumstances would have been impossible due to the feedback by the public.
Mm. So that's the Environmental Protection and Conservation and Biodiversity Act. But in terms of climate change law, which is what you specialise in, you said there's not really that much of it out there. But still, you've got these three amazing cases that you're working on, and you filed. Two of them are against the Australian government, and one of them is against a big insurance company. Are you able to speak about those and kind of what legislation you are using, like what is at your grasps to file these kind of cases?
Yeah, so the legislation we use and the law we use doesn't specifically refer to climate change. There's two cases which deal with financial products. So the first, which we filed 2 years ago against a big superannuation fund, REST. So that's one of the, I think it's in the top 10 or close to the top 10 funds in Australia. It's like $60 billion worth of assets they manage. So huge amounts of money. That's filed under the legislation that governs superannuation funds. And so that legislation says that the trustees or the people that run those funds need to act with care, skill and diligence, and they need to act in the best interests of the beneficiaries. So people like you and me who, our employers pay 9.5% of our wages into super funds and we can't access it until we're, 60 years old. So because of that dynamic, the people who run the funds have certain obligations. And these obligations have been around for a long time. They're a sort of a part of what's generally known as trust law, and they're a part of this legislation which came in 93 and was improved in 2013. And so we say, because climate change is such an important issue, and not just from an environmental perspective and a moral perspective, but also from a financial perspective, because as climate change hits, it changes energy systems, you'll have stranded assets, you'll have all sorts of impacts on investments. And that superannuation case is premised on the basis that these risks are foreseeable, they're really big, and the trustees need to do something about them to protect the interests of you and me and our client Mark. So it's using what we're doing is using existing laws and saying that climate change is such a massive problem, and in this case for investments, that people who choose those investments need to do so really carefully and need to protect everyone, especially younger people who won't get their money for a long time, from those risks.
And when you say money for a long time, are you referring to the other case, which is the CATA, versus the government? That is such an incredible case. I was reading about it yesterday. Can you break down that one?
Yeah, so that's that particular financial product is the government bond, which is essentially a loan. So the government now is borrowing heaps of money, a lot of money, to afford JobKeeper and to prop up the economy in COVID times. And so the debt, our debt, and you'll hear ministers talk about debt and talk about a surplus. This is all about government bonds. And so what this case says is that for the issuer of a bond, which is the Australian government, they need to tell people who lend the money about climate change risks. And our client Kata, she's 23 years old. She owns like little slices of bonds that you can buy on the ASX. And some of the bonds she owns won't mature. And so these bonds have an end date. And so you basically lend the government a bit of money. They pay you interest every year. And at a certain point in time, they pay you that money back. So it's just like a regular loan.
But it's like 30 years, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely. So her the bonds she owns, or the money she's lent the government will pay it back in 2050. And so there's a really long time horizon for the bonds case as there is for the superannuation case. And we already see investors or entities that lend governments money starting to really think about climate change and the risks it poses to those investments. And so one of the things that CATA's claim does, it says, well, people might not lend Australia money if we're doing bad things on climate, if we're being obstructive in international negotiations, if we don't have a carbon tax, if we don't have an effective energy policy, if we, you see now the government promoting this gas-led recovery.
Oh, my God.
So it's things like that which go to reputational risk, and yeah. that might cause major bondholders to either sell out or just not lend the government any money. And so it's about getting the government to say, hey, if you lend us money, one of the risks is that we might have, you know, or sorry, it's a financial product, right? So it's a bond. One of the risks to the bonds is that they might change in value because of what we do or don't do about climate change. And so it's kind of getting them to fess up. And so they could say, oh, look, we're doing all this really horrible stuff, but it might risk your investment. Or they could say, oh, look, we're starting to do all this really good stuff and we think this will be good for your bonds.
Mm. And that kind of reputational risk, it's already been an issue. Didn't the Central Bank of Sweden put in a policy around consideration of like where they put their assets? And then they've kind of pulled out of stuff in WA and Queensland because of the large carbon footprint that their policies are already doing. So that reputational risk is huge.
Yeah, 100%. So we see it, you know, crystallizing in the actions of Sweden. And there's almost two components to what Sweden did. There's a reputational aspect, and it said when it sold out of those bonds that Australia wasn't known for good climate work. But it also used the per capita emissions of Western Australia and Queensland, used them as a sort of like a proxy for financial risk. And it said, well, these issuers in Australian dollar bonds have really high per capita emissions. And to us, that says that those states just aren't, they're not ready for a transition, which is inevitable. And so we think when that happens, you know, because they're not ready, they're going to be riskier investments.
And does that also stand to reason that if you're not now preparing for that transition, when the inevitable transition comes, you're going to be less able to kind of accept the change? And would that make the economy more destabilized? And it's a bit of an alarm bell going off for international investors. They're like, well, those guys are not even close to being ready. Like, I'm not going to touch them with a 10-foot pole.
Absolutely. And so it's real, it's a very common, if not universal view that if you're not ready for the transition, the more it's going to cost. The more it's going to cost the economy, the more it's going to cost the government to like change things quickly. So yeah, investors are really alive to that.
Mm. And you mentioned stranded assets before, which is something that I'd like to kind of flesh out just a little bit more in terms of what that means in the scope of climate change.
Yeah, so I guess the general meaning or general sense of it is, you know, for a project, if you say have a coal mine, and you've pumped a lot of money into getting it up and running, and you know you've got train lines and infrastructure. If the coal market collapses, or if it declines to a point where it's not economic to extract that coal and sell it, you'll have a project which is stranded, which you can't use. I mean, if they keep digging up the coal and it actually costs money, or they make a loss, businesses just can't do that. And so it'll kind of sit there stranded because it can't be used. And usually, or quite often, there might be debt associated with it. And so if a bank has lent money to get the mine going, that's the financial risk to them, because that money won't get paid back.
Yeah.
Because as the world changes, and it is changing, and you still see these projects going ahead, that there's huge risks of them being stranded and investors not getting their money back.
Mm. The third case that we've already kind of touched on, but I want to flesh out a bit more, is the class action against the environmental minister. And that's a group of 8 students. Are you able to talk to me about that case?
Yeah, so that's a case precisely of a new fossil fuel project. And the case works on the basis that the federal minister for the environment under this EPBC Act, the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act.
Do lawyers just use the acronym, or do you just have to get the mouthful out?
Yeah, look, I could just speak in acronyms and I'm sure no one would
understand. I'd have no idea what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah, so sometimes we just call it the Act. So this Act, right?
The
so,
Act.
So as we were talking about before, the Federal Environment Minister needs to sign off on this new coal mine project. It's new in the sense that there's no coal that's been dug out of the ground yet, but this particular project is sort of an extension to, you know, a smaller project, but it's essentially a new project. Mm-hmm. The minister, so under that legislation, there's all this consideration of threatened species and ecosystems and offsets, and it's been approved at the state level in the sense that it's like, yeah, there might be some problems with like a honey eater or, you know, some bats or whatever, but yeah, we can deal with that with offsets or other conditions. And so the state has approved it. The next step, which is happening now, it goes to the minister, federal minister for the environment to approve it. So she must make a decision. So she essentially has the control over whether or not it's going to go ahead. And because of that, she's in a really important position, a position of power, a position of responsibility. And we say that when she makes that decision, she needs to do it in accordance with a duty under the common law. And so this is judge-made law. This is centuries of cases, mm-hmm. not legislation. This case says that the common law duty acts to protect vulnerable people, like children who can't vote, who can't run for office, who are essentially relying on the minister in this particular case not to approve the coal mine and therefore keep the coal in the ground. Because if she approves it, inevitably the coal will get dug up and burnt and contribute to climate change and contribute to all these horrible and serious impacts into the future that younger people will face.
Yeah. What about the Paris Agreement? Like, can that, I know that's not a legally binding thing, but surely that agreement, can that be used in any way to be like, look, Australia's agreed to this amount of emissions. We're trying to, this is our target. And if we make this new coal mine, that will be too high for our Paris Agreement.
Yeah. So in the case with the students, we don't talk about the Paris Agreement. We simply say that if coal is burnt, it will produce CO2 and that will contribute to climate change and make all these impacts and cause harm to these children. So it's almost like coal is a poison. Mm-hmm. Carbon dioxide is a poison. And the minister has the obligation not to let the coal being dug out of the ground so it can be burnt. And it's kind of like if you sort of poison, or, you know, you tip a can of paint down the drain. It's not like you can tip, you know, half a litre down. This case sort of says that you can't tip any because it's a poison and it's going to cause these impacts. Mm-hmm. Where we have used the Paris Agreement is in the case against the superannuation fund. And so for investors, the Paris Agreement operates as a really big market signal. And it says, look, the world's moving this way. You know, you've got this international agreement, you know, 190 or 200 countries, if there are even that many, have signed up. And it's their intention to limit climate change to well below 2 degrees or to 1.5 degrees. So that's the way the world's going. You need to be ready for that. Investors need to be ready. And so you've had the regulator of superannuation funds say, yeah, look, this is a thing. The Paris Agreement is real and investors need to be ready for that. They need to, you know, look forward and stress test their sort of their assets, their portfolio on the basis that the world will meet that target. And therefore they should be thinking about getting their investments ready for that. Mm. So that's how that case uses the Paris Agreement.
Yeah. The three cases that you're working on, just before you mentioned that there is common law and then, sorry, I'm coming at it from a very simplistic place, but just want to get my head around it. So you have judge-made decisions that set almost like a precedence. Is that right? And so you can use those cases as like an example of, well, this was this case and the judge made this decision, therefore it's similar to our case, and you can use that as like supporting material. Is that how kind of how it works?
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, so this idea of common law is an idea of sort of doctrines or standards that gets made purely through cases which are designed to protect people. And, mm-hmm. you know, protect people from harm or from poisons and things like that. But you do also get judges talking about how statutes and acts are interpreted. So you get judge-made law on both. And so that there's a lot of judge-made law on how the sort of environment legislation is interpreted in Australia, but mm-hmm. that's not what the student's case is about. It's about when you use that act, it's about what you should think about and the standards that come from common law that we say should force the minister not to approve it because of the climate impacts.
Mm. So does that stand to reason that if these three cases that you're working on do go through, they will be used as a precedence? Because you're really at the forefront in Australia of this kind of climate change litigation.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And so that's right. And so these cases will create precedent either way. And, you know, they'll create precedents on how statutes are interpreted, and especially with respect to specific facts. And so mm-hmm. so with the superannuation case, that particular superannuation statute or act will be interpreted in a certain way with respect to climate change, and that could be really important. I mean, that may send a signal for other super funds to do more on climate change, and who knows, it might even help sort of nudge the economy along if for example a court makes some comments about divestment and decreasing the risk and risk of exposure, say, to stranded assets. If you get money moving out of them and into other parts of the economy, like renewables, then that could really, really help change the economy. Mm. And it's a similar thing for government bonds, and of course a similar thing for the common law duty, which you know is really important for, especially for younger people, for people in positions of power. So for them to have an expectation that they'll be protected. So yeah, that's a very important case.
Mm. And if you think about it internationally, I know there's a couple of cases that happened, one in the States where a group of students themselves, they also sued the government. And then there was one other case, I think, in Holland. Are those cases also able to be used as precedents in Australia? Like, are we able to use international cases?
Yeah, they can be sort of influential to a degree, but they don't sort of force the court to act in a particular way. Mm-hmm. That there might be certain cases, say, for example, in England, where we get our common law from, that might be binding. But because, you know, since Federation, we've had our own laws and our own court and our own constitution, and so judges in Australia will typically look to Australian cases and Australian law as a sort of a strict, you know, how to be guided. But when we're entering into new territory and when we're dealing with climate change, I think these other cases around the world can be really useful to help Australian judges.
What makes it so ambiguous? Sorry, I should say that in a different way. Climate change is obviously, it is like such a hyper object, and it is a very like ambiguous thing in terms of like emissions go up and where do they go? You know, like you can't see it. Is that why climate change law doesn't really exist? Because it's hard to be like, well, you emitted this much and it went into the air and that person, but then it's affecting this island. You know, like it's kind of this, how do you even like, what would climate change law look like?
There's plenty of things that the government can do to create laws around the around climate change, like it's almost endless, you know.
Oh wow!
There's so many things, right? Like, I mean, if you think about a carbon tax, that's essentially a law that regulates the maximum amount of emissions that, or you know, or makes people pay for emissions and therefore gives them an incentive not to pollute. You could have laws saying that you'll have no new coal mines. You could have laws. You can have laws saying almost anything, but we don't. There are some instances of climate change being a necessary component of decision making, but it's not really very strong, and often it's not enforceable. You know, Victoria has some climate change legislation, but it doesn't, in practice, make many sort of projects non-viable. It is just a consideration, and it could be considered as a tick box, but like it's a start, and so it's really good, and government needs to be thinking about it. But so we're left with a situation in Australia where we do need to use existing laws and principles to try and combat the climate crisis. Absent our government enacting these laws that might otherwise help.
Yeah. Where do you think the most pressure will come from in the future to get those laws made? Is it going to come from international? Like, I kind of feel like money talks. And so ultimately it's going to have to come from some sort of money-centered finance investment push.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what... I mean, I guess that's what our cases concentrate on. And you see that the law operating to protect investments or to protect people and people's health. And so the cases, three cases we're running are about those two things. They're not sort of directed at protecting the environment. It's an indirect impact on investments and people's health. And so I think that's where it's going to come from. Precisely what those trigger points are, I don't know, but there's a growing body of research out there which says that as climate change gets worse, the economy will suffer generally, and people's investments on a broad scale will suffer. So that kind of makes sense, and it's like, well, at the end of the day, if you don't have a sustainable economy and everything's too hot and you've got extreme weather events and society can't exist and function properly, then there's an incentive to fix that by super funds or by investors. I think you're right. That's where the pressure will probably come from.
Do you think in the future we will, I mean, this question seems maybe a bit redundant now that I realise there is no climate change law, but do you think there'll ever be a possibility that we can sue the government for damages?
Yeah, there's that the science around what's called attribution is getting quite advanced, and so that sort of talks about, you know, if a certain event does happen, how much more likely was it to happen as a result of climate change, and you know what certain policies or projects might mean in terms of their contributions. So you know the law generally works in a sort of reactive way when it comes to damages. Our three cases are different because they peer into the future and they seek injunctions. But you know the way class actions normally work is say, oh, you've lost a bit of money or you've been hurt, then you get you can go to court and recover those losses. So you're put back in the place you otherwise would have been. That obviously works in monetary terms. It doesn't sort of work on injuries and things like that. So it is possible, and you do have cases around the world starting to look into that. There's a particular case on behalf of a Peruvian farmer who's seeking damages from a German coal company for the extent of their contributions to sort of how the glaciers are melting and the financial impacts on their farming activity. So it's starting.
Mm. So interesting. I just have one final question. I don't want to steal too much of your time because I know you're so busy with all of this stuff. I'm curious what ways individuals can kind of constructively exercise influence on this. Like, are we just, you know, I'm just a person, can I help in any way? How can I help?
Yeah, look, we're all just people. I mean people need to do more than sort of vote for or vote against people in every 3 years or so in elections. I mean, that doesn't seem to be working. There's so many ways. I mean, there's so many opportunities now to get involved in things like, you know, Extinction Rebellion or local groups that talk about sort of broader issues and might put pressure on the government in certain ways. Mm. Yeah, and you know, there's your own sort of personal habits when it comes to sort of travel and emissions and eating meat and that sort of stuff. And it's funny, you know, the people we represent were involved, you know, like Mark, who's, you know, he was 23 when he first wrote to his superannuation fund. He signed up to get some emails from an outfit called Market Forces who exist to help educate people about what their super funds are doing. And he did that. And at the end of the day, he wasn't satisfied with their response and got in touch with us. And so this is how things start. You know, Kata studies law and she's interested in what she might be able to do with respect to climate change. And I met her at a lecture that I gave. These eight students we represent in the case against the minister, they're all part of the School Strike Climate Network and organising protests. So you know, it's you never know where it can lead.
Yeah.
And certainly encourage people to be really active and it's also, we're also learning that it's good for people, you know, it's good for people's mental health to be able to actually feel like they're doing something.
Oh, for sure.
And yeah, get out there and get involved as much as you can.
Yeah. And stay curious as to where is my money actually going? Like what do they do with that investment that I've made or.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Well, that's all so interesting. Thanks for your time, Dave. I really appreciate it. I hope all these cases that these things seem to take forever. Is it like a year on year kind of trajectory for these cases, or do you think some of them will be decided on pretty quickly?
Yeah, look, it can be. I mean, Mark first wrote to his super fund in August 2017. Right, that's over 3 years ago.
Wow.
But things are coming to a head. So we go to trial in that case in the first week of November. Mm-hmm. So that's really exciting. And you know, that gives you some idea of how long these things can take. But that said, for the case with the students, there's a fair bit of urgency to that because we're trying to prevent the minister from making a decision to approve the mine in a way that will cause these impacts. She has a sort of a defined period to do that. And so that's coming on really quickly. That's also, we have a hearing in the same week on the Friday, on the 6th of November to ask the court to give us a temporary injunction to stop her from making that decision pending a full trial. So things are starting to happen, right? Hopefully we'll get some more clarity around the law and people's responsibilities with respect to climate change really soon.
Yeah, cool. Oh, well, maybe we can check back in 6 months' time and see what happens.
For sure. That'd be great.
All right, Dave. Thanks so much for your time. I super appreciate it.
Thanks, Tessa. It's a pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
What a cool job. I'm really looking forward to following along those cases and seeing what ends up happening. And, you know, hopefully they swing the right way. And even if they don't, as David said, that'll set a precedent. For those who are interested in knowing more about this, marketforces.org.au is a really great resource to get an idea of where your bank or your superannuation fund is at in terms of investing in fossil fuels. So check them out. They've got lots of free, easy to digest material. And it's a good place to start to just, get your head around all this stuff. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Again, these are released fortnightly, so I'll catch you then. Bye.